Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Bruce Arena, after a U.S. game one time, came and sat next to me on the bus on the way back to the hotel. And I remember it so well, him turning to me and sort of quietly whispering, "Don't become Clint Mathis." And I was like, what's he talking about? Clint's the man. I mean, this guy's incredible.
Welcome to the Coffee and Football Podcast. I'm Sebastian Alvarado, and I'm the host of this show where I sit down for a coffee with some of the most interesting and influential profiles in the game. Today's guest is Kyle Martino. He's a former professional and U.S. national team player who probably is even more well-known in his current role as a Premier League studio analyst than he was during his playing career. We see him almost every weekend on NBC Sports together with Rebecca Lowe and one of the two Robbies, former Premier League players Robbie Musto and Robbie Earle. We go in-depth on the studio job, the behind-the-scenes and the amount of preparation that goes into it, what it's like to be the only American on the show. We get in on his playing career that ended at 28 years old due to injuries, the post-career type depression he experienced that led him to leave the game and take a job on Wall Street. We also touch on what it's like to be a team owner. Together with his friends Steve Nash and Stu Holden, he owns Real Mallorca of the Spanish 2nd Division. All that and much more in this episode, so without further ado, let's get into it. Kyle, welcome to Coffee and Football.
Yeah, thanks, man. We already had our coffee, too. It literally is coffee and football.
It really is. But I didn't see what kind of coffee you had. What do you typically have?
I'm trying to find my lane here. I wasn't a coffee drinker before I had a child, and my two-year-old daughter, Marlo, right when she came into the world, so too did my coffee drinking. And I have yet to land on a favorite. Right now, I'm drinking French roast, and it's all right. It's okay. But I think it's more for the caffeine vehicle than the actual taste.
Right. So you thought it'd be a little solution to your sleeping decree.
It's a major solution to my sleeping issues.
How are things today?
Everything's good. I just, you know, kind of funny enough, after just getting done talking about my daughter, Marlo, I just had my son, Major. Well, I didn't. My wife did. She did all the work. But yeah, he's just over 2 weeks old. And that's when, this podcast and this conversation comes at a very interesting crossroad in my life, and it's very apropos to reflect on things, because in my life never felt so, I would say, just different from how you expected the path to feel like when you grew up. I mean, nothing feels more grown up than changing diapers, waking up, going to work, and having a house full of kids. And you know, it's been a really remarkable, amazing journey to get to this point. But it is a state of serious reflection when you look at others. I think for the first time in your life, not to sound like a narcissist, but the reality is, when you have kids, you love something much more than you love yourself. Right. And that is a very fine tool of understanding who you are in those moments when you no longer are looking as much inward. You're more getting inside yourself and looking out to see what your life has become. And I'm very lucky that it's on the path that it's on right now. Fortunately, I've got an amazing partner in my wife, Eva, and we commiserate and celebrate at the same time this incredible joy and exhausting journey of being a parent.
Well, first, obviously, congrats.
Thank you.
On the newborn. Are you both on maternal and paternal leave?
Yeah, I mean, when you're in the sports world and in the television world, paternity leave doesn't last very long. You know, the Premier League sort of waits for no man. But my bosses have been incredible and understanding, and I'm lucky that I've got the Robbies as well, that we already have a natural rotation where they've given me a little bit of a break to be at home in this moment and really, really enjoy my son and be able to spend a lot of time with the family before I get back into the other children of the insanity of the Jose Mourinho's and that whole world. It's not necessarily diaper changing, but it is crazy and hectic all the same.
And you recently moved from the West Coast. You were actually commuting from LA to Connecticut on a weekly basis. How has the move been for you?
You know, it's been really good. I was traveling back and forth from LA, which, you know, we loved where we were, and I went to LA initially because I was working for Fox, and it was right down the road. And when Premier League came along, it was after I was already working for NBC and was traveling a lot, but I was working in-game commentary for Major League Soccer and traveling all around the country. And when, you know, you're doing that sort of job, you're always going to be traveling. So it doesn't matter where you live. You can live wherever you want. But now that I had a very stable and the repetition of always going back to Stanford and being a studio guy, it really gave us the decision of, do we change our life? Do we move over there and make it easier? Because the commute, although there are great aspects of it that, you know, that's six uninterrupted hours on a plane that I'm just able to crush work, just reading articles, watching games. And it's probably the most efficient I can possibly be, because no one's there to interrupt you there. But that's cutting out what's the most important thing in my life, which is family. And I was in the backyard with my daughter Marlo one time, and the plane flew over, and she looked up and pointed at it and said, "Dada." And I think that was really the moment I was like, I got to stop this. Wow. This is not the life I want for myself, but much more importantly, I don't want for my kids that their dad's constantly traveling. And it was the way I grew up. My dad was always on a plane and always traveling around, and it definitely had an impact on me. And that was when my wife and I sat down and decided to come back where I grew up in Westport, Connecticut, which is right down the road from Stanford, to move back to this area. And it's been great. You know, obviously we miss LA. We miss certain aspects of our life that we had built there over the last decade. But the trading a 6-hour door-to-door commute, and well, even more than that, trading probably a 10-hour door-to-door commute for a 35-minute door-to-door commute definitely improves the quality of life.
What does your wife do?
She was an actress for a long time and has recently started a lifestyle blog. And the genesis of it was that she's an Ivy League grad who is incredibly intelligent and has different interests she didn't feel she was utilizing her intellectual capabilities, but also a lot of her passion in the world of acting. It's something that her parents did and something that she sort of just found herself doing and fell into. And it was the natural path to get on when it was something that was around the house for her growing up. But she started writing a little bit just to sort of scratch an itch, and realized not only that she had a talent for it and had a following that responded to her writing and her aesthetic, but that it could be a business, that it could be something that she could build. And when she made the decision to leave acting and poured herself full time into that, she's just really grown so much. I mean, there's so many aspects of her life that have changed recently, becoming a wife, becoming a parent. But it was when she really took ownership of her career, and instead of waiting for opportunities to be told she could go act, she has taken the initiative and the risk of creating this business by herself. And she really just wows me every day with what she's doing and how she's connecting to people.
Take me through a typical day. I guess there aren't all that many typical days in your life.
Yeah.
But maybe we can start with kind of what kinds of morning routines do you have? So what time do you get up?
Yeah.
What types of readings do you have? And then from there on.
So the morning routine has changed a lot recently due to having a newborn in the house. But a typical morning routine is waking up around, you know, 6:45, 7 with my daughter Marlo, going in and picking her up from bed, which is definitely, outside of the coffee we talked about, one of the best, most just the perfect start to the day that you get to see what you're doing it all for immediately, and to see the positivity she wakes up with, that sort of innocence that a child wakes up, you know, dreams still lingering and ready to start a day, and not sort of bogged down with all the other noise that we tend to let accumulate in our heads and in our souls. I get to start with her, come down and have breakfast, and just laugh a little bit as the house sort of wakes up and everyone, you know, gets ready for their day. And then take my daughter to school, you know, drive 5 minutes down the road to take her to this great place that she has all these friends, and just runs it right from the start. Of course, she's very much her mother, and the fact that, you know, she arrives and immediately starts organizing the joint. And then come back home and kind of get my work day started. I've got a great office set up here at the house that was one of the necessities of not having that plane ride anymore, was to have a little nook to tuck myself away and be able to, you know, to really get down to the things that I want to accomplish during the day. And it involves, throughout the day, when I don't have the time and am either with my family or my daughter and not trying to detach and separate myself, I'll email myself articles and all these things that I need to get to. And that'll be my time during the day that I sit down and go through my inbox and, you know, read The Guardian, read The Mirror, read The Daily Mail, read ESPN, read Fox and NBC and all the different sites that have great writers, football writers that are writing about reflecting on the past games or anticipating the weekend games. And I'll just use that and curate this, you know, this thread of what's important right now in soccer, what's important in the Premier League, what should I be paying attention to, and what do people think about what's going on right now, and help that either continue to evolve my idea of this past weekend or help me create my counter argument if I don't agree with it. And so it's very valuable, I think, to you know, to accumulate this. And this modern day with social media and blogs and podcasts, you know, it's really endless, and it's so helpful to have so many different voices and so many different ideas on one subject. But I'll try to gauge the temperature out there on what's important and what people think about it. And then I'll go to game watching and see how those theories play out, and either past game scenarios or, you know, try to really think through what I anticipate being the strategies of the weekend. And then, you know, come to a Friday night and you've really done all your work and you're ready to go. You've studied for the test, and Saturday mornings end up being super early. I'm up at sometimes 3 a.m., you know, get upstairs, you know, tiptoe out of the bedroom so I don't wake anyone up. Come downstairs to, actually, we're still working through this routine. We don't have it as good as we did in L.A. where I was not there to wake the entire house up, but get out of the house, drive, probably get to the studio anywhere between 4 and 5 a.m. and then start sitting down with one of the Robbies and Rebecca in the makeup room. And that's one of the most fun parts of the day is, you know, we're exhausted. We're sitting there. We all look like crap, and we're waiting for them to actually make us look like we're not zombies that just woke up at 3 a.m. But that's when we have our, you know, sort of water cooler talk. And that's when I compare my notes of what I've thought is important and what I've heard and the opinions I've formulated and bounce them off of the other guys on our team. And, you know, even though Rebecca's the host, she's very important in that process as well, because she's got very good opinions and a great eye for the game. And she joins us in helping to sort of not only articulate the thoughts and ideas we have, but try and fit them into an opening chat that's very small. I mean, that ends up being the difficult part of our job, is we'd love to be able to talk all day. I mean, a format like this, as you can see, I can talk all day, right? But a format like this affords you the opportunity to really, expound on ideas, thoughts, and be able to drill a little bit deeper. But we have, you know, 50 things we want to talk about. Each of those things could take 10 minutes each, but we have one, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 minute window at the beginning of the show to talk about what's important. So it's hard to really to condense it into a very concise idea of what you find important and what's interesting in the Premier League coming into that weekend. But that first makeup room conversation is our attempt to do so.
And it's all very kind of soccer focused immediately there?
Or you know, there's it's funny. We've never really, it's not like we came up with a format of how to chat. It's very conversational and very spontaneous, but we do have life chat first. You know, it's sort of current events, whether it be, you know, this election and all the craziness of that, or Brexit was one thing we were talking about, or it's just, you know, kids and you know, someone's got a cold, or yeah, it's golf, it's fashion. It really can be anything. Nothing's off limits there. So we kind of check back in with each other and have that chat. And then Rebecca's normally the one that transitions it to, okay, opening chat, what are we going to talk about? So, we don't just dive right in. There's a little bit of foreplay.
in all that content that you consume, you know, between Twitter and the articles that you read and the games that you watch, what's the balance kind of between what you just gather and kind of curate based on other sources versus what your own opinions are?
Yeah, I would say that it's all my opinion. It's whether or not I agree with other opinions or I don't. And so typically with the amount of content and the amount of analysis, I mean, sort of everyone has this job, whether it's you're getting paid for it or not. Everyone with a Twitter account or a Facebook account or a blog or a podcast or whatever they're doing, everyone's formulating an opinion on the weekend. And typically we're all talking about the same thing. So what I like to do is not formulate my opinion in a vacuum. I have my thoughts after I've watched the weekend's games, and then it tends to coincide with, at least subject-wise, what other people thought was important from the weekend. And then I think it's really important to have a gauge of what fans, what other pundits, what other players, what other coaches think about those certain issues and topics coming from the past weekend, and then really join the conversation and put my two cents in. And my two cents may be, I completely agree with what this person said, or it might be, I completely disagree with what this person said. But more often than not, it's, you know, the subject is Jurgen Klopp doing a good job at Liverpool? I say yes, and this is why. And so I think it's incredibly valuable to make sure that you are as knowledgeable as possible, not only on the subject matter, which your playing career helps shape some of that opinion, but also, you know, you don't have to have been a professional soccer player to have an opinion, or have even played the game to have an opinion, a good opinion. So the next part is what did I see and what are my observations of it? And then lastly, I think it is really important to have a feel for the temperature out there. For instance, if my thought is, you know, Jurgen Klopp's doing a bad job, I need to be aware that that is a minority opinion, and understand that I have to really have a strong, you know, example and strong backup for that opinion, because I need to, in my job, be aware of where opinions fall and is what I see important, not important to others, and things like that. Because I think people don't want to be talked to. They want to feel like they're in the conversation. So that's how I think a lot of us try to make our analysis more conversational rather than, you know, sort of talking at people that don't have opinions. Of course they have opinions.
Do you have any mentors or any coaching help who offers you kind of a POV on your work and who keeps you on track and helps you evolve in your role?
You know, we do a lot of review with the Premier League. There's actually, I wasn't on this past weekend, so I'm not on the call, but there's a call going on right now that has our entire production team. And fans don't get this view, but we do. You realize that it's not luck that we're covering the game in a way that's so appreciated by a fan base. It's because there's so much going into it. I mean, there's a research team, there's an edit team behind the scenes, there are producers, there's 40 or 50 people behind, you know, the Robbies, Rebecca and I, that are helping make this such a professional and engaging broadcast. And so, you know, that helps a lot. And every week it's sort of a different person, a producer, an editor. I like that. The guy leading things, there's a few of them, but Sam Flood, Pierre Moussa, Adam Littlefield, these guys are making sure that we're constantly trying to improve ourselves. And this call where we talk about some of the good things about the broadcast and the weekend, but also point out some of the mistakes and things that we can do better, is really helpful in trying to constantly keep us on our toes. Outside of that, I would say a mentor of mine when I started, and even though I'm doing a completely different thing than he's doing, was one of the first COCOM guys I worked with, was JP Della Camera, who's been in the business forever and just was such a comforting presence when I first started out, had no idea what I was doing and was probably terrible. And he was there to lean on in those moments, but also was just really helpful in trying to, as a new analyst, give me a few things to think about, just a few things to focus on to try and improve myself. And I definitely give him a lot of credit for helping me come along in this and create a career for myself. And, you know, now we just sort of check in with each other as good old buddies. It doesn't really have that sort of, you know, mentor-mentee feeling anymore.
What do you do in your role better than anybody else? What's that one thing that you're kind of uniquely qualified to do?
That's a good question. I hate,
feel
hate
free to
bragging
brag
about myself. Yeah, I mean, I would say that I would say that what's a bit unusual is someone that works as hard as I do in this. And, you know, I don't mean to say that others aren't. Of course they are. But I really just like try to lose myself in this thing and you know, study for 1,000 question multiple choice test when it's only going to be 5 questions. And I've really obsessed about it like I did my playing career and all the time I spent training and working on things. So that work ethic, you know, it used to be a bit unusual and is becoming more the status quo as the soccer audience becomes so knowledgeable and can really pick out someone that isn't doing the homework and isn't watching the games and brushing up on everything. You know, I think one thing that I would say I do well that I always focus on because I can always do better at this that is unusual because people want to be liked and it's difficult to have a very strong opinion and also be liked. So what I try to do is just really be definitive. I try to not sit on the fence a lot of times, which was hard because I started this career at a young age because I had a career-ending injury. So I was talking about players that were still friends of mine that I still saw on a regular basis. And I had to have very critical and clear, concise analysis on games that was difficult when you were talking about a buddy or a coach that's a friend of yours or something like that. So very early on, I got thick skin about, you know, not everyone's going to like me, but I think it's important to the job we have, it's important to have a position, to put yourself out there and say what you think, whether it's on penalty calls or whether it's on, you know, coaches doing a good job or whether it's about players and how they're performing. I mean, you have to really be strong. And, you know, a lot of times that's opened me up for a serious amount of criticism, especially being the only American on the Premier League coverage. But, you know, chasing away that insecurity that still exists in me, I still have the desire to be liked and still, you know, worry whether or not I'm in the majority in that opinion. But those two feelings are detrimental to, I think, strong analysis and strong commentary, because you really have to not let likability and desire for your opinion to be in the majority to motivate your analysis and guide your analysis. I mean, it is a really hard skill to learn and to quiet the ego, but the more I've done this and the more confident I've become and I deserve this job, I've worked really hard for it and I'm good at it. It's made it easier to have these opinions that either open you up to being disliked or open you up to being discredited. I mean, those are two things that analysts want to avoid. That I would say my commentary, as it's improved, has improved because I'm less conscious of those two things.
Have you ever had an encounter with a former teammate or coach who's been really pissed?
Give me an
example.
So I remember that I was doing a U.S. game and a good friend of mine to this day. And you know, it's just like when you fight with guys on the practice field.
And his name is?
Carlos Bocanegra. Yeah. So he came up to me afterwards. I'd met the guys out for drinks as I would after the games. I still kind of was, even though the commentator for the night still felt like I was one of the guys in the locker room. And he came up to me and was really visibly, and I didn't have to read between the lines, you know, noticeably upset with some of the things that I had said during the broadcast that he disagreed with. And we sort of had it out there. And you know, that was my first test in standing up for what I believed in and making sure that I was okay with this reality. This was going to be the life I chose, which is you are going to, not artificially, I'm not the guy that's creating controversy because it gets my name out there or, you know, moves the needle and gets you hits on these social media platforms. But I wanted to be a guy who was respected for calling it like it is and saying it like I saw it. And that night actually helped me a lot because the conversation ended that way, where he gave me a compliment in his criticism of me, even though he disagreed with me. He said, you know, I give you a lot of credit for coming out and saying that. And, you know, a lot of times you'll do that and you were wrong and you end up having the wrong view of things, but it can't keep you from either those run-ins or, you know, coming up on the wrong end of a prediction that you have and you feel strongly about. It can't keep you from going out there and putting yourself out there like that.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit. I want to ask about your background.
Yeah.
How was your upbringing?
It was loud. Yeah, we had a big Italian household. So I've got 3 older brothers and 1 younger sister. So
tell me about the Italian background.
Yeah. Well, my dad's side of the family came over from Italy, his grandfather, Arcangelo, and everyone ended up in Providence, and it was sort of that quintessential Italian-American backyard bocce and the wife beater is getting your hair cut on the porch by Uncle Louie sort of existence. And then my mom was just the complete other end, sort of Southern belle, and her family grew up in the South. But that Italian heritage always kind of stuck with us. You know, we're loud, we have our big noses, and we just love everything Italian. And, you know, I grew up watching the league. It was so fortunate when I was little that Serie A was on and Rai, and, you know, you had very little outlets to watch the game, but that just happened to be one of them. And it was always Juventus or it was Milan playing on the weekends. And that's kind of how I fell in love with the game and also stayed in touch with that heritage. You know, my dad kept in touch with a lot of our relatives over in Italy, and I was able to get my Italian citizenship. So stayed a dual citizen. And it was always just, you know, it was always something that was a part of our household growing up. We ate way too much pasta and, you know, started drinking red wine at an early age and enjoying a lot of the perks of being a part of that culture. But my wife actually grew up part in Rome. So it's something that now is even more prevalent in our family. We're both Italian citizens and want to sort of keep that thread going and make sure that our kids are introduced to that culture as well. Now, my wife's is a much more authentic version of the Italian heritage than mine. Mine's the sort of not to... to appreciate it or minimize it, but sort of that more sort of watered down Italian American that, you know, like she can't stand that, you know, like bolognese and calling, you know, marinara sauce a gravy and all these other weird Italian American things that will drive actual Italians up the wall, like my wife. But it's yeah, it's definitely something that's important to us.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad worked for IBM for 40 years, and my mom was had the harder job of staying home and raising us, which to this day, now that I have kids, I call her to apologize for any difficulties we gave her, because that is such a remarkable and courageous job to park, I'm sure, interest she had and aspiration she had to the side and spend the majority of her time making sure that we were taken care of and that we grew up to be good people that could contribute to this world. And you know, she really is the template that I use when I think about the type of parent I want to be. And you know, the other side, the professional side of it, is my dad worked so hard and traveled so much and missed so many amazing things that I'm sure he would have liked to have been there for. You know, part of me has my dad's work ethic and aspires to be the best in his industry, just as my dad aspired to be the best in his and came very close. But but my dad would agree with this, not, you know, make sure that it's not a cautionary tale that you didn't become the best in your industry at the cost of losing a little bit of the connectivity with your family.
What's the best lesson they taught you that you carry with you today?
I think different lessons for both of them. My dad taught me sort of strength, and there's a solution. You know, you can find a solution. And, you know, for instance, one time he this is sort of a phrase that sticks with me. There's a difference between cash flow problems and money problems. For instance, you know, don't let the feeling of the situation skew the reality, which is, you know, you might feel like, oh man, how are we going to do this? But understand that there are people that are trying to make things happen that have problems that you feel like are your problem, but they're not. And making sure that you have that perspective and feeling not tied up in, you know, the difference between feel and real. But my dad was sort of the ultimate pragmatist, and I've learned a little bit of that from him. Now, too much of that is a very bad thing. So what I've learned from my mom is to let emotion come through and not be afraid to be vulnerable and not try and use logic to hide away real feeling and real emotion. So my parents are sort of the perfect combination of human being that I try to be on a daily basis, that I have my struggles of probably leaning more towards my dad's side than my mom's and needing a little more vulnerability and a little more emotion in my life, because I tend to fall into the pragmatist role a little too easily.
Tell me about the moment when you first realized that you're a talented soccer player and that you might have an opportunity to make it into a career.
Yeah, I mean, I think at a young age, there was definitely a love for it, for sure, starting around, you know, 4 or 5 years old. it really wasn't until I would say probably like 13 or 14 when I started getting more attention, whether it be from coaches or, you know, other parents. And it started to become more professional feeling, where there was this track you could get on at that point. It wasn't just a game you were playing anymore. There was sort of college looming at that point. There was a professional league here. And back then it was the Olympic Development Program. So you'd make your state team. So I'd play for Connecticut. And if you made Connecticut, you'd have an opportunity to make the regional team of Region 1. And I made the national team at a very young age, at 15, in the first year that I made all of those teams. So I made the state, Connecticut state team for the first year, then made the regional team in that first year, then made the national. So that was kind of a big eye opener, because before that, you really had no measuring stick. You only had that sort of small pond measuring stick. And, you know, it can feel like you have a certain acumen and excel at something when you're in this sort of small pond. But I knew better than to think that meant I was really good at this game. It was only until I got in that really large pond and got the recognition that I kind of looked around and said, whoa, I may actually have something here. And it didn't matter if I was going to excel at it or not. It was something I loved and something I was going to keep doing. But I think that ended up being the justification to really lose myself in it. And it was the encouragement to continue to grind and maybe let other things kind of fall away that I was splitting my time playing soccer with doing. For instance, I played a lot of other sports, and at that point, those all sort of faded away. And I really just became fanatical about getting to a certain level. Of course, it was my dream already at that age to do it for a living. But more, I didn't want to feel like there was any excuse for not becoming the best at it that I could be. And so I used to go down in the basement and duct tape a square and just spend hours and hours down there trying to perfect certain technique. And I'm sure there's some OCD in there as well. OCD that still exists when it doesn't have an outlet like that can become a very dangerous thing. But yeah, I would say that was when I realized that, yeah, there's something here.
And then you ended up enrolling at the University of Virginia, which is a powerhouse when it comes to soccer. What was the experience like there?
It's interesting. How I remember it is my first humbling experience, because it was probably the hardest soccer environment I had been in up to that point, for sure. But that being said, as a freshman, I was playing. I was a starter. So I remember it as a humble experience, but it was something that I took to right away. So that again was this compounding encouragement and sort of confidence that you need, that I had made a huge leap from high school to one of the best, you know, Division I programs in the country and hit the ground running. Almost kind of like in an addict sense, that made me, it gave me a high. I mean, that made me hungry for the next high. I mean, that's kind of one of the cautionary tales I talk when I go speak with kids and go back to my high school and club team and stuff, is I talk about there's nothing wrong with setting goals and aspiring to reach a different level. But that was kind of the beginning of being out of touch with the moment. I mean, I was so hyper-focused on the next game, the next team, the next level, that I never really sat and enjoyed the moment. I would say, you know, 75% of the time, I was so overcome with this feeling of an unfinished project that I felt like enjoyment was complacency. And I think that a certain level of that is a mistake. You know, complacency is a dangerous thing, but enjoying something and thinking, man, this is amazing that I've made this team, that I'm playing in this game, that I'm, you know, here in this moment, I think that's a very important part of being able to hold on to the love of the game, because at a very young age, I kind of fell out of love with the game. And I think that's the reason why.
Yeah, and I think those characteristics are fairly similar across a lot of professionals or people who have played at that level. Did you set actual goals in terms of, in 2 years, I want to be at X level, or in 5 years, I want to be playing at such team in Europe? Or was it looking, perhaps, I want to make it into the MLS as my next step?
I mean, this is going to sound conceited, but I really only had one goal, because this goal would have checked all the other boxes. It was to play in the 2002 World Cup. And I, at that point, this was kind of in high school and in college that I started thinking about this. I just assumed I was going to be a professional soccer player. I mean, at that point, it was just, there's no way this isn't going to happen for me. You know, the track I was on, it was going to be my fault if it didn't happen, not some unlucky turn of events. So the only goal I really set during my career, which this kind of goes back to be careful how you motivate yourself, because if that's my only goal, then I failed in my career. And, you know, I feel that way sometimes. There are definitely times where I'm a little bit depressed about, for sure, how my career ended, because it ended with a career-ending injury at 28. But mostly because I had created this idea that I was only going to be successful if I played in that World Cup. And I got hurt in the January camp before the run out to picking that final team. And, you know, who knows if I was healthy, if I would have made the team anyway. But I can look at that moment and it definitely elicits this disappointment in me.
Did you mainly keep that to yourself, or did you communicate it to other people?
Yeah. My dad. My dad was the only one I talked to about that.
What did he tell you?
He just said, always dream of that World Cup. Yeah, don't be afraid to say it out loud. And, you know, it was where it became difficult is when, you know, players and coaches around me, without me saying it, started saying that there was a chance that I was going to be there, you know, because they kind of said my goal out loud for me, which sort of took the pressure off of me having to say it. But I knew that that was what I was aiming for. And, you know, I definitely created now a scenario where I wasn't going to be happy unless it happened. And, you know, I can rehash it as much as I want, but, you know, it's hard to really come up with what you could have done differently, because a lot of that obsession of making that World Cup team led to my successes. So, you know, it's so hard to do in hindsight, try to think about what was the better move, what could you have done better. All I can do now is try and reach back to moments that I can still derive some happiness from, that I sort of wasted in the moment. And because they were wasted then doesn't mean they were wasted forever. I think what retirement brings out a lot of people is if they're able to reflect and understand why they're depressed, because majority of guys are, it's just natural when you live your whole life aspiring to be something and your identity so wrapped up in it, to have it end one day. You know, it's, I call it the Peter Pan complex. All these professional players think they're going to do it forever and never really mentally prepare themselves. Maybe they professionally prepare themselves for what happens when they're done playing, but not mentally. I mean, that's what I've worked through for the last 10 years is trying to understand what my playing career meant to me and trying to find all of the happy moments that, even if they were in defeat, that I should take from a career that was really fun and really special.
How do those feelings typically express themselves among players? And do you guys, the retirees or the friends, do you guys talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's historically been such a macho profession that, you know, no one talks about feelings. I mean, the quote unquote locker room is not the place to air all of those things. Fortunately, we're in a much different place now, and it's become okay to talk about the mental health of players, and it's okay to share emotions and feelings and be vulnerable. Doesn't mean you're not going to be a strong man or strong player. And, you know, Landon Donovan's a good buddy of mine, and we've had a lot of these conversations. I mean, he's a very existential sort of character to begin with. John O'Brien's another one that, you know, he and I, our careers ended similarly in the fact that it was injury that took him away at a young age. So yeah, there's definitely guys that I have these conversations with, a sort of support group of ex-athletes that either, in Landon's case, his career is still going, but who you would think have nothing to regret, you know, nothing left to prove, got absolutely every last drip out of a playing career, reached the absolute height of it. But of course, Landon has regrets, and every player will. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, when Messi's done, he's going to have regrets. It's just part of the neuroses of being a professional athlete and all the crazy nuance and also unrealistic atmosphere that you're put into, that going into the real world is very disjointing. You know, John O'Brien is actually going to school for his PhD in psychology and the sports psychology focus to try and be an outlet for a lot of these athletes and help build either a platform or a curriculum for current athletes to use through their clubs, or for retirees to help them, almost a halfway house to help them reacclimate to what it's like to not be Kyle Martino, the soccer player anymore, what it's like to just be Kyle Martino and how that fits in and how you fit into your new life and how you adjust and also the fact that you are still the same person in so many ways. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about in that area, and there's a lot of, fortunately, I've got some good friends from the playing days to help work through those things.
assume, as you just mentioned, one of the things being that people know you as a somebody when you're a player, and I guess there's a certain rush that comes with that. How would you say that in your current role, because still very much being a public figure and seen on TV, and I guess you might even have your own little fan groups here and there, has that kind of replaced those feelings, or is it comparable in any way?
I mean, really, I'm more recognizable now than I was when I was playing. You know, it's funny, I went back to go speak at my high school, and you know, the coach said, "Does anyone know who this is?" And they all raised their hand and said, "Yeah, that's the Premier League guy, Kyle Martino." And really, none of them knew that I actually played the game. You know, it's like, that was a humbling but hilarious moment. And you know, that's not... It's going to sound like lip service, but that's not really, of course, what I was in it for, because, you know, our league, not one of the more watched, not one of the more celebrated. You know, there were times where I was on a plane with the Columbus Crew and people would lean over and say, "Crew, like the rowing?" You know, you get humbled when you play Major League Soccer in those early days. It's different now with how much it's grown. But what I was in it for was how it made me feel, how I saw myself. Did I see myself as a good teammate, as a good player? And, you know, that's why it's so difficult, because if it was about being recognized and the rush that you got from whatever bit of fame or claim that came with that, then I'd be pretty happy right now, because I'm more recognized than I was as a player. The people are loving the Premier League coverage. So that should have made things really easy. But the reason that it didn't when I first retired is because my demons are very much my judgment of myself. And even if people think I'm doing a good job, I could think that I'm doing a terrible job. Or even if people think I'm doing a terrible job, the good part is I think that I'm doing a good job and I believe in myself. So, you know, there's sort of the good and the bad of having such a microscope on yourself and being so hard on yourself.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Going back a little bit, just on the playing career, you were drafted by the Columbus Crew in 2002.
Oh man, I believe. It was a long time ago, yeah.
And had a phenomenal start, became the Rookie of the Year. And I guess you're mostly associated with the Columbus Crew because you spend more time mm-hmm. there. How would you describe kind of that initial time of becoming a professional?
Yeah, it was... It was an I've made it kind of feeling. You know, it was okay. It's so short lived though, but it was all right, I'm here. You know, this was one of the biggest goals of, you know, when you're young, was that idea. And as I said before, it was sort of for me, I assumed it was going to happen, but still there was this brief moment of celebration in that preseason when not only that I had been drafted and that I signed a professional contract, but I noticed I belonged and it happened. I remember we were down in Florida, but at the Bulletary Sports Academy and playing in preseason against other teams. And I remembered there being this insecurity that creeped in of what happens if I get found out? Like, what happens if I'm not good enough for this? That was a real fear, but kind of going back to that difference between my mom and my dad, you know, the emotional me would have accepted and understood and tried to sort of investigate that feeling. But the logical me just said, "See how you do in training today." And in training, I was picking it up pretty quickly and felt to be one of the better guys out on the field, and immediately just said, "Okay, back to 2002 World Cup. I mean, that's the focus. You're here. Now let's start to work on that." So, you know, things in that first season, to going back to that sort of weird borderline between cockiness and confidence, I wasn't starting right away. There was this guy who played for the Colombian national team, John Wilmar Perez, who was the starting attacking midfielder playing in front of John Harkes or Brian Mazenov. And I kind of really quickly thought, I'm better than this guy. I should be out there. And didn't really see the field in the first like six or seven games. And I remember Mike Clark, who was the captain at the time, came to me and said, you should be playing. You know, we all know it. And it was so important to hear that from him, because I started to doubt myself and I started to think, this is where you get really insecure, is when you're saying, am I not a good judge of myself? Am I not a good judge of what's actually a good player? And am I just seeing something that no one else is seeing? And that thought, when it creeps in your head and grows, can be such a cancer. I mean, it really can just zap confidence. And you see it in professional players that are veterans. It's not anything that you can kind of get rid of permanently. But that was a big moment. And, you know, that kind of gave me the support that I needed to just get back on the training field and continue to prove it every game, and didn't give the coach zero reasons to not put me out there. And finally, in one game, he started me, which was maybe a difficult decision as I look back in hindsight to rest a World Cup veteran, Colombian national team player, for this young, skinny, long-haired kid that hadn't played one professional game. But I started that game and started every game since in that season and got Rookie of the Year. So that was a big crossroad, because I think, even though I talk about this obsession with the game and this work ethic, my mentality was susceptible. It was vulnerable. And I could be discouraged at that point, because I had had so much built up and so much desire for it to work. It becomes easy in those moments. And this is why these guys who have these long, great careers are so impressive. It becomes easy in that moment to just give yourself a break and say, yeah, it's not going to happen. It's all right. It's not going to happen. You know, thank God Mike Clark was there that day to help chase that idea out of my head, because it would have been a much different career.
So this is in the spring of 2002. When did you make your national team debut?
It was that season. Yeah, I think 2001 was my first season. So yeah, that was in 2001, I believe. And then it's all blurry. But 2002, I remember my first game. It was against El Salvador at RFK.
Tell me about the call-up.
It was crazy. I mean, I had known Bruce Arena I played with his son at University of Virginia, Kenny, who's a good friend of mine. And Bruce would come to games and had invited me a few times to come train with DC United when I was at University of Virginia. And so a call from him wasn't unfamiliar, but in this context was very unfamiliar. I got a call saying, you know, we're going to be calling you up for this next game. And you get an email at that time from Pam Perkins. At that, you know, Bruce kind of said, we're looking at you. It wasn't a sure thing if I was going to get called up. And you get an email from this wonderful woman who was the coordinator for the national team for a long time, Pam Perkins. And when you got that email, you were in. And the email was, give me your ticket information, where you're flying out of, and all this sort of stuff. And when I got that email, I just couldn't believe it. I was you know, going to get to represent my country and play in an international. And that was, I remember I didn't start, and I was going through training that week. It was just so crazy. It was so much fun. And I didn't start, and I came on towards the end of that game, and I was just crazy nervous. I just remember feeling like I was going to shake right out of my shoes. And I got in that game, and I was just like, don't give the ball away the first time you get it. Whatever you do, just do that. And the first time I got the ball, I sidestepped a guy and just passed a sort of 10-yard pass to Landon. And I remember Landon looking up to me after that play, kind of giving me, I think he had seen how nervous I was when I came out, and kind of giving me the, you got this, like, nice start to coming on. And yeah, that was a really cool moment. I mean, that's when I talk about in the moment. I don't think I really realized how big it was, how great it was, how much it would mean to me. But now I can go back and sort of almost a time capsule of happiness, open it up and see what it meant to me to be in that moment.
Who were some of the players in that locker room that made the greatest impression on you?
I mean, definitely Landon, because, you know, he was younger than me. And when we were young, he was always the star of his national team, and I was of mine. And our national teams, they had the great success at the Under-17 World Cup. And because of our age group, we kind of missed our under 17 World Cup. We were kind of too young when it came the last time and now too old for that one. And we would always scrimmage them, and there was this huge rivalry and a jealousy. I was just jealous that he was so good and he was getting a chance to prove it and was, you know, such a star at that World Cup. But underneath jealousy in any circumstance is envy and is respect. And there was an incredible amount of respect for him. So he was definitely someone, even though I was older, I looked up to. Brian McBride, I played with for the Columbus Crew at the time, and he was just incredible. He was one of the best professionals I ever played with in terms of not only how he worked on his game, but how willing he was to help others work on theirs. You know, Eddie Pope was a huge figure at that point. He was someone who was so impressive and so helpful to new guys coming into the team. And then Clint Mathis was just an intriguing one. I mean, he was kind of the like, you know, tortured genius that I was more like the game that I wanted. I wanted a type of game that I could pull things off that weren't either quote unquote American or weren't expected of players of our ilk. And so he had a certain talent and a certain swagger that I aspired to. But actually, a funny story about that is Bruce Arena, after a US game one time, came and sat next to me on the bus on the way back to the hotel after the game. And I remember it so well, him turning to me and sort of quietly whispering, "Don't become Clint Mathis." And it was sort of I think he noticed that I was enamored with him and liked his irreverence in the way he played the game. And, you know, Bruce didn't want me to lose my creativity, but he didn't want me to be creative at the cost of sometimes being destructive.
Did you get that right away, or did he have
No, I couldn't know. When I was young, I was like, what's he talking about? Clint's the man. I mean, this guy's incredible. But I would say above all of them was Claudio Reyna, who was one of the reasons I went to UVA. I kind of wanted to emulate everything that this guy did. And I just looked at his game and thought it was flawless. His mastery of in-game situations and how calm he was, how good he was on the ball. I mean, he was someone that when I actually was in my first national team camp with him, that was one of those sort of kind of pinchy moments.
What's something, and because you mentioned Landon, and I know you have obviously, but both Landon and Claudio, great appreciation. What's something that makes them so special that's not part of kind of the common knowledge?
I actually talked with Landon about this at length one time. I honestly think it's decision-making. You know, Landon and Claudio, I could show you a dozen players that are more skillful than both of those guys that didn't have anywhere near the careers that they've had, because they had this. And what I can't figure out is how, because they didn't have typical development upbringings, is how they were able to see the game the way they saw it. And what I mean by that is be able to make decisions and take pictures beforehand and have such an incredible feeling of where danger was, where opportunity was, and to have that in-game awareness and that decision-making. That's very atypical of what I would call definitely myself and a lot of talented American players that are reactive. I mean, they're just out there, and because they're good on the ball, because they're good athletes, because they have a little bit of soccer IQ, they're able to pull off a good play. But Landon and Claudio are just this different ilk of player that knew the right play and saw it before it kind of happened. And that's really the big difference between, you know, the U.S. doing well in World Cups and winning World Cups is we need a team full of guys like that that have such attuned in-game senses that they really aren't flustered and aren't being dragged around the field, that they are very much in control of what's going on.
Who's the first person that comes to mind if you told me who the absolute craziest one was?
But I mean, it's easy. We were just talking about him, Clint Mathis. I mean, the guy was, he's one of those ones where you kind of like, you know, people talk about George Best. If George Best wasn't so destructive and thrill-seeking off of the field, would he have had a longer, bigger, better career? The argument to that is his career might have been because of that. I mean, his sort of, you know, his zest for life and his, you know, Paul Gascoigne could probably fall in the same category. They're all similar players, right? If you think about it, they all had this incredible ability to grab the game and entertain, and all of them were similar off the field. I mean, it's kind of just that was their personality, and sometimes you see a person's personality come out a lot in the way they play, and that was the case with Clint for sure.
What would be a story that you tell at a bar?
Oh, geez. Most of them he wouldn't really be happy that I told him, but I remember one time And this was when I first got into the national team. Maybe this is what led to Bruce's conversation with me on the bus that day, but he wanted me to go with him after training because he'd become really close friends with Wilmer Valderrama, the guy from That 70s Show. And we were at a training camp in LA. He wanted me to go with him after training to pick up Wilmer's Maserati because Wilmer said he could use it while he was in town for the national team camp. And so, I go with him to drive up the Hollywood Hills to go pick up this guy's car. And then the next day at training, instead of getting on the team bus as we normally do to go to training, he convinced me to get in this Maserati with him to drive to practice. So he and I, and in hindsight, what the hell was I thinking? Drive up to the Home Depot Center and this, you know, TV star's Maserati and get out like it's no big deal. And of course, that was probably, you know, a couple of guys thought it was really cool, but I'm sure more of the guys thought, like, look at these idiots. And that night, Clint asked me to come out with him. He was going to go out with Wilmer, and I decided not to. I thought, you know, I've probably taken this further than I needed to as a sort of quote-unquote rookie in the U.S. national team. And Clint had a huge blowout night at, you know, all these, like, A-list clubs. And had like fallen over and broken his watch and like was out until 6 a.m. and just drove straight to training the next day. But here's the thing about Clint and other guys like Clint that really lived a little too much off of the field. He was able to come in and train at a high level the next day. And that's where you really have to learn that you can't hang with some of these guys. And I learned it with some of another one of my close friends, Frankie Hayduk. I tried to keep up with him one night. And next day in training, he was running all over the place. And I thought I was going to completely spontaneously combust on the field. So, you know, you say what you will about how crazy some of these guys are and how crazy they live their lives. But, man, were they exciting on the field.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different DNA altogether with some characters. Just briefly, you transferred from Columbus to the Galaxy, had a few good seasons there. Did you ever have the opportunity or was there, since you were, you know, part of the national team, was there ever talk about clubs in Europe?
Yeah, when I was actually in high school before I went pro, I was approached by Benfica to not come back for my second year at UVA and to sign a contract with them. We had had a youth national team tournament in Toulon with the U.S. team, and I had done really well. And, you know, that's one of those, again, regrets of I decided not to do it and go back to college. I mean, that was my first opportunity. The next one came after I had gotten my Italian citizenship. It had opened up a lot of doors to being able to go easily to Europe and play. And I had gone over after a really bad injury. I had torn my hip for the first time, and it had coincided with my MLS contract expiring. And instead of signing a new MLS deal, I decided I was going to go try to, there were a couple clubs interested, go abroad and go on trials. And the timing of my injury was terrible, where it was going to take me a lot of the off season to get healthy enough to make it for the next season. But then I was going to miss my window at going and trialing for these teams. And if it didn't work out, coming back and playing in MLS. So I went over before I was entirely fit and ready, but went to Holland first to NEC Nijmegen and had a great trial there. And found out afterwards that I was brought in because their attacking midfielder was kind of holding them ransom for a new contract, and they were worried he was going to leave. And so I came in, performed well, and they kind of dragged me along until that guy signed a new deal, and I was immediately asked, you know, thank you, but no thank you, you know, you can move on. And I went to Leeds at that point. And again, had a really good start where they put me with the reserves first, performed really well in the first reserve training. Then they put me in with the first team for a week.
Were they in the championship?
They were in the championship at that point. And then this is the crazy thing about trials. They asked and started negotiations with my agent at the time. And, you know,
who was your agent?
At the time then it was Lyle Yorks, but it was a European guy over there sort of acting on behalf of Lyle Yorks. And it looked like I was going to sign a contract, and they wanted me to play in a reserve game as a sort of a last look. And it was Dennis Wise and Gus Poyet. They were the coaches, and they wanted me to play in this reserve game. I think it was against Sheffield, and it was Sheffield United, and it was a side rain, wind like you wouldn't believe, pouring down rain. And I play in this game that, you know, if I think back, didn't perform poorly, but no one would want to watch this game again if they were paid. And based on, you know, that game, didn't move forward with, I mean, it's sort of the margins are that. Or that's small, and the decision's that quick where that was it. And if I stayed any longer, I was going to miss my opportunity to go back and sign with the LA Galaxy. And they had just announced David Beckham was coming. So I thought to myself, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience to go play with a player of his caliber. You know, who knows, I could hang out here and keep going through trials and eventually find a team. But, you know, at that point, I was beaten up. I'd come back to play way too early, so I needed actually to go back and rehab more, and decided you know, it's not going to happen, and went back and signed with the Galaxy and started up again with them.
What would be the main things that stood out in the European game, although obviously Holland and England are vastly different? Yeah. But what would be like a couple of things you would pick from...
For the championship, it's probably a good thing that it didn't pan out, because what stood out immediately was how physical and direct it was. I mean, it just wasn't the game that I excelled at, and wasn't the game actually I really wanted to be playing. And it was cold, it was wet, people didn't like you. You know, I've talked with actually a couple of guys that have gone over there, either on trials, or Landon told me this about going over to Bayer Leverkusen. It sounds crazy and it sounds paranoid, but it's true. They won't pass to you. You'll go over there, you're on trial, and you're basically trying to take one of these guys' positions. So they will, as much as possible, try to make you not look good. And it was crazy. I, you know, guys had warned me about it, but seeing it in the flesh, it was nuts to see it. Holland was. I wish that one worked out, because it was a beautiful kind of that idea of total football. I mean, it was ball on the ground, building out from the back. It was very... wasn't as physical, wasn't as fast, but it was very cerebral. It was a great tactical game. And that was definitely something that, you know, I don't regret the championship opportunity not working out, but I do regret not working out in Holland, because I think I really would have had a good time there.
Yeah, and it's usually a great stepping stone to the next level, even within the European game. Obviously, your career ended at a very young 28 years old. But what was that moment like, and how long did it take to actually finally make that decision?
So the decision was kind of made for me to a certain extent, where my injury had gotten to the point where the doctors had kind of advised me, listen, it's your decision, but our professional opinion is you need to stop playing. And it was Dr. Mandelbaum, the U.S. doctor, and I sat in his office. And once I realized that I was never going to be the player I'd set out to be at that point, and really took the temperature of how much I was enjoying the game. And at that point, I wasn't at all. I just didn't love it anymore. And I was scared that if I kept playing, I was never going to love it again. So it was kind of like when you're in a bad relationship and you know you need to break up in order to maintain respect and love for each other. That's kind of what it was. And I sat in his office, and he took out a recorder for insurance purposes, and we recorded his professional opinion that I was going to stop playing and that I decided to retire from the game. And that was one of the only times in my life I just broke down and started crying. And that's a bigger problem than my career ending, is that I've only cried once that I can remember. But I was devastated. And sometimes I think maybe it wasn't as much that I was devastated as that it was tears of relief that I didn't have to try and prove anything anymore. Didn't have to try and battle to get to a point that it didn't look like I was going to make it to. It was kind of a relief that was over, because I was really tormenting myself and finding ways to blame myself and judge myself for not getting to the height that were expected of me, that I expected of myself. And so that was a hard moment, and it led to, you know, many years, and even still today it pops up into my head from time to time, of really working through what that meant to me, and letting out emotion and mourning the loss of something really special to me, which was a playing career that I worked so hard for.
And I assume after that you probably wanted to get as far away as possible from the game.
Yeah.
What was the first real job you got after that?
Yeah, so I wanted nothing to do with the game. Almost like keep an alcoholic out of a bar. I just knew that it was dangerous for me to be around the game. And so I went and worked in the most natural of transitions after professional athletics. I worked in finance and went and worked on Wall Street in 2008, right before the financial crisis, which, by the way, I did not cause. Let's just go on record. I did not cause the financial crisis, but I contributed.
How did you get in there?
One of the partners of the firm was a soccer fan and just, you know, cashed in at what was left of my career notoriety and, went and started working there. And actually, there were aspects of it that I really loved because it was competitive. It felt like a team. It felt similar to what I was doing before, although sort of unrecognizable and easily justified as not professional athletics or athletics, but had so many of the same qualities that I really enjoyed and, you know, became intoxicated with again.
What was your position?
I was what was called an RM, a relationship manager at a wealth advisory firm. So basically a big shop that does financial planning and insurance and estate planning for high net worth individuals. I was sort of almost like a guy that fished and went out to either get new clients or maintain relationships with current clients. And it was fun. I learned a tremendous amount about the industry, but more about myself in that time. But also, it was when I started to dabble in doing a little bit of commentary. ESPN had asked me, since I was living in the New York area, to call a couple games when they needed a fill-in. And, you know, if I wasn't working in finance and working in such a different world so far away from the sport, I don't know if I would have found it again. It was because I wasn't, it's kind of like that relationship thing of you'll find love when you're not looking for it. You know, I fell in love with the game again because I wasn't desperate to. I'd kind of let it go. And it was when the pressure was off that I really started to let that love grow and that light sort of increased inside me that you know, was kind of that first love that I'd found way back when I was 4 or 5 watching, you know, the Italian league. And that's when I knew everything was going to be all right, that you know, I didn't know yet at that point that I was going to be a pundit, that it was going to work out. But I just knew, you know, I can love this game again. And I may never have a professional relationship with it, but it's, you know, sort of good to see you again.
In your role today, what are the worst parts about the job beyond travels that we already kind of touched on?
Yeah, I think the worst parts are definitely, you know, it's more of an annoying part than, you know, it being something that's bad about the game is or the profession is everyone's an expert, you know, and having to deal with everyone's sort of insecurity, especially when you're the only American covering the game, about you being able to get this position and you being able to commentate on what they think is their league and their game. You know, a lot of the sort of mindless vitriol that gets hurled in your direction when you do this job. But, you know, I would take 1,000 times more of it if it meant I could continue to do this job. So it's something that I, you know, all of us that work in this industry that are public figures have accepted that is part of this job.
Is there any rivalry between you and your colleagues or even other people, say, who are working for other channels? Because you all have big egos, obviously.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a lot about individual career and you guys managing your own brand in a way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's rivalry. You know, it's a very healthy one. You know, my peers that are in, you know, the sports, or, you know, Taylor Twellman or Alexi Lalas or some of the other guys that are doing such a great job right now. Of course, I want to be better than them, but not at the cost of them having great careers as well. You know, it's not a Machiavellian sort of feeling. It's a very healthy rivalry where I'm good friends with both those guys and we have lots of fun banter and I chat with them online and offline all the time. But of course, I don't get into anything, which kind of is part of my crazy personality. I don't get into anything without a desire to be the best at it. So, you know, I every day am trying to find an edge and an angle to be, you know, the best, definitely in terms of that healthy rivalry, but more importantly, in the rivalry I have with myself to improve on any performances that I've done in the past.
And this is, I guess, a bit of an outlier. There hasn't been a whole lot reported on it, but I did read something about you becoming, I guess, an investor, maybe not the owner, but mm-hmm. investor with Real Mallorca in the Spanish Segunda.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
it's funny. So Steve Nash is a very close friend of mine, and our friendship was built on a shared love of this game. And we'd always talked about different things to do together, and we had got involved in other business projects on the side, you know, just almost jokingly had dreamed about and talked about the potential of owning a team one day. And one day Steve called me with a possibility and he said, listen, you know, Robert Sarver, the owner of the Suns, has approached me about helping him to put together a project to go own a soccer team. And so, you know, Steve asked if myself and Stu Holden, another good friend of ours in LA, who we play soccer together down by the beach and have become really close friends, you know, if we would join him in that venture. And, you know, it took all but 30 seconds to think whether or not we wanted to do so. And then the process of finding a team and doing it took place. We took a shot at Levante and then weren't able to have our offer accepted there. And Mallorca was the second team we went for. And, it's so incredible to think after all of this, you know, I've been through and, you know, in this discussion with you, the journey of what the sport has meant to me and what I've been involved in. If you would have told me when I started it, you know, as a little kid right down the street, if I could be even a tiny percentage owner in one of these great clubs, an amazing league with an opportunity to help bring them back up to La Liga where they belong, I would have thought you were crazy. So, you know, it's like fantasy manager. Our fantasy has become real life. And it's amazing to be involved in the process of understanding how a football club works and how it's run. But more importantly, just being a little part of trying to help it succeed.
Do you get like full insight into everything that's happening at the club?
Yeah. So I had a list of all of our the current players and salaries and who we're going for, what they're going to cost, what we're paying our coach, who's our coach, how he's doing, the you know how many tickets we've sold. I've got all the info and more than I could ever sift through to understand. But it's been a really amazing experience to have the hood lifted to see how one of these things run. And you know, it's an incredible club with an amazing history, and it would just be such an incredible accomplishment and feather in all of our caps to in a small partake in helping this club get back to greatness.
How would you describe yourself as a team owner? Or are you like the Southern Italian type who fires the coach every few months?
No, I'm the level-headed one in the group. No, I mean, everyone, our opinions are more for consultation and support for the people that are making the real decisions. We're not here with fingers on any buttons. And it's a good thing we're not, because we're just a bunch of guys that love the game that, you know, from all the way over here couldn't fully ever understand what that club means to its fans and what really will make it work. We're just trying our best to add some soccer voices and soccer minds to a conversation that's trying to accomplish something pretty special with a great club.
Where are they in the league right at the moment?
We just got out of the relegation zone in the Segunda Division, and it took the last game of last season to survive. So it's a long project that has its challenges, but we're optimistic that we can make our way up the table this season. And I would say survival is definitely the goal. It's promotion is maybe a little bit too early to be talking promotion to La Liga this season.
We're getting to the end here. I'm just going to shoot a set of rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
Favorite team?
Barcelona.
The biggest moment in your playing career?
My first international goal.
In your post-career?
My daughter being born.
The best player you played with?
Claudio Reyna.
The best player you've played against?
Pirlo.
Best team?
We played the Barcelona reserves. Oh my God, were they good?
What team was that with?
I have to look back because I'm sure.
Yeah, but you were with.
Oh, I was with Columbus Crew. But it had to have been a lot of the guys that have been in the first team over the last, you know, 5 years.
A recommendation to somebody who wants to get into your position?
Do the reps. Doesn't matter what game. Just if you want to be a commentator, you want to be a coach, you want to be whatever it is, find someone that'll let you do it and do it as much as you can.
One piece of advice to your 20-year-old self.
Look up and notice the day.
Who's the most well-known soccer contact in your phone?
Probably Beckham.
Give me three people in the soccer world, past or present. Let's assume language is not a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
You get to take them for dinner. Who are those three?
George Best, Paul Gascoigne. There's going to be a lot of hilarious stories at this dinner table. And Maradona. Let's just make it crazy.
Where would you take them?
Somewhere they don't serve alcohol. I would take them to my buddy's Italian restaurant in Brooklyn. He's got this place, Lilia, that's absolutely remarkable for some really, really good Italian food.
How can people follow you?
On Twitter, Kyle Martino at Kyle Martino on Twitter, and that's really my only social media. I'm already obsessed with my phone enough as it is. I don't need any other avenues to connect with the world, so that's the best one.
Do you have anything you would like to recommend?
TED Talks. I've been listening to TED Talks recently. I definitely tune into those, and they'll talk about things you never even thought you were interested in.
Is there any particular favorites?
There was a TED Talk about the mathematics of love that was so crazy and amazing, about this woman who's an economist trying to figure out if she could break the algorithm on how to find love. It was fascinating.
Last one. Who do you think I should interview next on this pod?
Tim Howard. I think he's got a lot of interesting things to talk about in life and in the game, for sure.
Maybe you know somebody who can point me in that direction.
Yeah, we can see what we can do.
Sounds good. Kyle, thank you so much.
Thanks, man. This is fun. I'm
very much appreciated. Thanks for the coffee, the invitation to your home. Wish you the best of luck, obviously, first and foremost with family, but then also in your role, and look forward to keep our eyes open for you.
All right. Thanks for the chat, man.
Thanks. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe on iTunes, write a review, tell your friend about it. I would truly appreciate it as we grow this podcast one listener at a time. If you have any feedback or ideas, feel free to send me an email at sebastian@coffeeandfootball.com. You can also link up with me via Twitter. The handle is @coffeesfootball. Stay tuned for next episode. It will be another amazing one. Thanks again, and have an amazing week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.